Welcome back to California Burning, made possible with funding from Sierra Nevada Brewing Company. I'm Matt Fiddler. All five episodes of the series can be heard for free in podcast form at californiaburning.net. But this episode is all about fire in our communities. Not way out in the forest, but where we live, in the area we refer to as the wildland-urban interface. These are sounds from a forest thinning project around the Paradise Pines Property Owners Association just north of Paradise, in Magalia. Chipping up woody material removed from the forest and left on the ground as mulch. This helps improve water retention and general health of the forest soil. But the big goal is to thin the forest to a condition which more closely resemble the forests that pioneer and founder of the town of Chico, John Bidwell, knew.
I like John Bidwell, you know, and one of the things that I've read about him is that he rode his horse from Chico all the way over to the coast, to Manchester, I think it is, and he rode his horse there, from Chico over there, and you think about doing that now, and it's like, there's no way someone could
over the Mendocino Forest, basically.
Exactly.
That's Jim Houtman. He's a former firefighter and now helps the Butte County Fire Safe Council. Jim drove me all around Magalia, sometimes getting rained on, showing me forest thinning projects along with his colleague, Callie Jane DeAnda, director of the Butte County Fire Safe Council.
We are trying to manage this forest. We're trying to set it up for survival, and it does require us to take some trees out.
I asked Callie Jane and Jim to show me some of the Fire Safe Council's projects surrounding the town of Paradise, to explain how they're done and why this is important to do in a fire-prone area like Magalia, half of which burnt in the campfire.
We did a forest management plan for the community of Magalia last summer and found that the forest was about 150% overgrown. Basically, you want to be able to move through the forest just the way the fire would. If you can touch a tree, then the fire would burn from one tree to the next. We want to break up that space so that there's a room for fire to come through and not ignite one tree to the next. So one analogy is if you can ride through the forest on a horse at a full gallop and not run into a tree, that would be a picture of a healthy forest.
So you take out the small trees, the dying or sick trees and brush, leaving large, healthy trees, creating a more resilient forest that has a much better chance of surviving a wildfire.
What we've been doing is working with our partners for our community wildfire protection plan. So we bring together a bunch of partners and then design where do the projects need to take place, where there is the most critical risk to fire danger in the communities. And then we wait for the right grant to come. And if it will fund fuels reduction or watershed health or forest thinning, then we write up a proposal based on what the grant's criteria and limitations are.
We drove up to various sites they wanted to show me, including Camp Kootalink, part of the Paradise Parks and Recreation District that was burnt during the campfire.
And we can see this area did burn fairly heavily. Again, the intensity of the flames coming out of the canyon, there was not enough space between the trees to slow that down, and it ran into that area.
The area was severely burnt, with very few trees surviving. But just a few hundred yards up the road, we can see a line where suddenly the trees are barely burnt at all and are expected to survive.
And that's this line on the U.S. Forest Service where last spring we came in and cleared out the vegetation fuels between these large, healthy trees.
So this road right here is part of that?
That's right. And so now we see these trees have a high survivability from the fire. From the design of the project, we just saw directly next to each other, one area burned very heavily, one area burned much, much less. And that was a direct result of that project.
We got out and looked around. Okay. It was about 70% covered by the forest canopy, like the prescription called for. And when the campfire came through, it worked as planned. Most of the larger trees survived, and the forest became nice and open. We then continued on a bit further to a project that started as a timber harvesting operation from Sierra Pacific Industries. Then the Fire Safe Council took over from there.
What we have here was a little bit of more open canopy than what we just saw on the U.S. Forest Service project. They were looking for a 30% canopy closure, whereas ours was a 70% canopy closure.
What that means is that only 30% of the sky was being blocked by tree canopy, letting in more sunlight than the 70% canopy in the U.S. Forest Service project.
And in this case, that worked very well for the design of the field break to help slow the fire intensity coming directly out of the canyon. They left a lot of oaks. You could see these nice large oaks. So there was a lot of species diversity, a lot of different types of trees. And what's we're seeing are a lot of healthy trees that survived the fire.
But with more sunlight reaching the bare soil, undesirable brush and bushes can come back more rapidly and add to the forest fuel load.
The nemesis, this is the Scotch broom plant. This plant can grow in the poorest of soils with the least amount of water, so outcompetes the native vegetation. And here it is on the edge of this great fuels reduction, just waiting to take over.
So while a much more open canopy like this does slow a fire down, it can also require maintenance, so certain invasive plants, like the Scotch broom and others, don't come back when it gets direct sunlight. This is why a shaded fuel break is the most desirable.
Having these trees here helps shade the area, so not as much stuff wants to grow back as fast because you have a lot of shaded area. But, you know, if there's no trees here, then the brush would take over.
Mm-hmm. A shaded fuel break is a break in the ground fuel while keeping the large trees to maintain the high canopy that blocks direct sunlight.
Another part of what you see here is that when they did do the thinning, they brought everything up. They took all the ladder fuels away. The whole design of this is to keep the fire low intensity on the ground, not travel higher up into the trees.
Which helps slow the spread of the fire, attempting to protect the most vulnerable parts of the community. Ingress and egress roadways, and just as important, protecting the community's water supply.
So we're standing at the bridge of Little Butte Creek on Hapkodalink Road, and the water flows are very high right now, so all this water is going into Paradise Lake. The good news here is the fire did not reach this portion of the watershed, and so the water coming into Paradise Lake doesn't have those concerns of the fire contamination.
The last stop of our tour was the Paradise Pines Property Owners Association in Magalia. Callie, Jim, and I got out of the car into the pouring rain so Jim could show me the Fire Safe Council's nearly finished project, thinning the forest that was so overgrown with burnable material you couldn't even see the beautiful hiking trail going through the middle.
So before, you couldn't tell that there was a trail here. So once they got in, we're able to clean out all the smaller brush and trees and everything. You can actually use the trail, see the trail, and move forward from here now and enjoy it.
Yeah, take a horse down here.
Maybe you're thinking, this wouldn't be a problem if the electric company, PG&E, had better maintained its transmission lines. PG&E has been deemed liable for the campfire. The winds were strong that day, and a sea hook failed on a transmission line that caused a spark, igniting the fire. But fires do start from lightning strikes as well. But natural lightning-generated fires in California usually happen during the summer, when the weather is calm. California gets hundreds of these every year, usually in remote places, and few people actually notice. Most of these catastrophic urban fires, Ventura, Santa Rosa, Paradise, and even the deadly 1991 Oakland Hills fire, these all occurred during the fall, when it's windy and bone dry from a long summer. But again, no matter how dry or windy the weather is, fire only occurs when there's an ignition. This is why PG&E filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, because it became clear that they're going to be liable for the destruction caused by the campfire. Here is Paul Moreno, spokesperson for PG&E.
Well, in this particular case, I don't know exactly why the sea hook failed. You know, all that's being investigated by various parties, but when that did happen, it separated the tower from the insulators. The insulators were holding the power line, which then appears to have come into contact with the metal tower and created sparks.
Now, one thing that surprised me was that apparently these transmission lines aren't insulated.
These high voltage transmission lines are not insulated. They are bare wires or bare conductors, and they're supported by insulators, and they run over very great distances. And because they're not insulated, there are clearances to keep space between the towers and the power lines and the trees and the ground. And those are those space and distances are also all created by regulatory agencies.
Ultimately, if they were insulated, though, then even if a Seahook failed and it hit the metal tower, wouldn't that potentially stop sparks from happening and then lighting, I don't know, the grass, I guess, on the ground or something?
Well, typically in a with the electric transmission system, both for our system and systems around the world, they are built this way, and the incidence of fires are actually pretty low, especially when compared to the distribution system. So because of the clearances that are in place and trees that are kept away from that, usually this has not been a big problem. But of course, with the changing climate conditions and the changing fuel conditions we've had, as you know, just, you know, any fire, once it starts during those conditions, can go on and on.
So yeah, on the distribution lines, do those tend to be insulated?
On the distribution side, we have primary and secondary. The primary lines, if they're overhead, are going to be bare. And the secondary lines, which are like the household voltage that runs directly to your home, those are covered. And they're lower in voltage. And of course, if lines are placed underground, well, of course, they're insulated and they're in conduit as well.
You know, after the campfire, because a lot of distribution lines were just completely burnt, of course, in Paradise and Magalia and the areas around that area, new poles went up immediately. Was that just standard operating procedure, or why did that happen really fast?
Right. Immediately after the campfire, our goal was to restore the electric and gas system so that the existing structures within the campfire footprint could receive electricity and natural gas service. By about mid-December, we were able to restore power to virtually all buildings that could accept power. And by mid-January, we could get natural gas service to virtually all the buildings in Paradise that could accept natural gas service. Later on in May, we announced that we would be rebuilding the electric system underground for Paradise and some other areas outside of the campfire footprint. So in the meantime, we're rolling that program out over about 5 years. So we're still going to use that temporary overhead system that we put in place. It's built to the same standards as we would a permanent overhead system, and we will have to expand that overhead in a few areas until we can underground those particular neighborhoods.
Is that on the radar for other foothill towns like, you know, Forest Ranch or Quincy? I mean, there's a lot of older foothill communities around here. Perhaps that they could use that. Is that on the radar of PG&E? Or?
Well, we can't commit to anything at this point, but certainly in the case of Paradise, because, you know, somewhere it's 90% of the town is going to be rebuilt anyway, and it's mostly an urban area versus a rural area. We think of our towns as being rural, but they're really kind of urban, or at least suburban. And that's where you often see underground utilities when you look at new suburban areas.
So how are lines maintained and inspected for safety?
Our regulators have schedules that we follow for inspecting and maintaining all of our overhead and underground power lines and equipment and substations. So typically, as part of our inspections, it's mostly a visual inspection that gets underway. In urban areas, we'll often do those patrols on foot because we have roads that we can follow along power lines. In rural areas, we'll often use helicopters to patrol because power lines will take shortcuts across canyons and across mountains and forests. And it's a very good way to patrol those lines and look for that. And if an issue is spotted, it'll usually be followed up with an in-person on-ground inspection that will get up there and get up close for a confirmation of, is that a damage or is that a worn part that needs to be replaced? Now, following the campfire, PG&E did do a complete inspection of our electric transmission system in high fire threat areas, and we brought in contractors to do very physical detail. They also use equipment such as infrared imaging devices to look for hot spots, which could be an indication of potential failure. So there's a lot of technologies that go into the inspection process as well.
What happens if they spot something? What's the procedure?
So if they do spot something, they will radio that information into our central aerial patrol center, which in turn will relay the information to the appropriate fire agency. And they're even able to follow up. So if the fire agency wants additional information or additional flyover, that can be done at that time. Another program that we have is we've been installing more weather stations and more high-definition fire cameras throughout high fire risk areas. In our San Francisco headquarters, we have a wildfire safety operations center. It's open 24 hours during the fire season. And the staff there, their job is to follow fire conditions, monitor them closely, follow existing fires, and work with agencies and get data from our aerial patrol, from our cameras, and from our weather stations. The weather stations, we're going to have several hundred out by the end of this year with a goal of a few thousand within a couple of years. That'll give us very granular data, real-time temperature, wind speed, humidity, and wind direction. And this information is available online. I think it lags by maybe a minute. And anyone can go on and see that as well.
And maybe that information would be used for when you decide to have some of these power shutdowns that are kind of happening throughout the state. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yes. So the idea is of shutting off power in a certain area of the grid is when we're forecasting weather conditions and fire conditions that indicate you get very strong winds, low humidity, red flag warnings, dry fuel conditions that could very likely lead to tree branches, you know, being blown into power lines and perhaps causing a wildland fire. And under those conditions, as you know, if a fire starts, it can spread very quickly. So we've implemented the public safety power shutoffs a couple of times in 2018 and once so far in 2019. Now, we can't predict how often or where these are going to occur each year because they're entirely weather dependent. But our goal is to give our customers 48 hours notice that there could be a public safety power shutoff affecting them and then update them again about 24 hours before the shutoff and again immediately before we shut off power. And once the weather conditions have passed, we will go out and patrol every inch of power line to ensure that there's no damage and it's safe to restore those areas. And then we'll restore power to our customers.
Paul Moreno, spokesperson for Pacific Gas and Electric, the power and gas company for most of California. You're listening to California Burning. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to learn several ways people are building safer houses and neighborhoods in California's wildland-urban interface.
They found in Laguna that when the firestorms were coming through, most often than not, the houses were burning from the inside out.
Stay with us.